Okay, it's my pleasure to introduce the speaker tonight, Connie. I met Connie shortly after I was released from Ridgeview about 18 months ago. Connie and I are in a big book study at St. Anne's. And I find Connie that she works a strong program. She is a spiritual person. She knows the big book. She works the big book. She works the 12 steps. She works with others. She's helped me quite a bit in recovery with what she shares in meetings. I've heard a story before here at Ridgeview. So I give you Connie. Thanks.
My name is Connie and I am an alcoholic. Wow. I just needed to get that out of the way. Breathe a little bit. I have told my story here before on Sunday night a couple of times. Steve, unfortunately, is ill and is not here tonight, but Bill, and I see some familiar faces, which lets me know that I'm in the right place. I'm with my family, so I'm at home. And all I have to do is stand up here and tell you the truth. And I ask God before the meeting to have me bring you the message that he wants you to hear tonight. I've been doing some work recently. I do a thorough house cleaning every year about this time, and I've not gotten started with it. And so in preparation for this, I've gone back through the book, and I've had some other awakenings. So I call them my little aha moments, things that I have still, with 5.5 years in this program, been denying about myself. So you'll hear a few things that are different, Bill, than the people that have heard it before. My story's not a whole lot unlike anyone else's. You know, I drank too much, quit working for me, and I got sober. And I've worked the steps, and I found a God of my understanding, and I found some peace and happiness and serenity today. And that's what my hope and my wish and my fervent prayer is for each of you in this room tonight. I was born in a very small town in El Dorado, Arkansas. Very lovely place to be from. I just don't choose to live there today. The rest of my family is still in Arkansas, and that is a great distance because they're all still crazy. And so am I, which you will hear. It's just I try to work my program so that it helps me on a daily basis to stay out of this place up here because it's a disease of the mind and the body, which I'll talk about in a moment. My father was an alcoholic. He died in recovery. He was a beer salesman. He had a beer distributorship. And up until a few weeks ago, I blamed not my father, but the fact that he was a beer distributor on the fact that I was different, that I felt different. That is not so. I came into this world maladjusted to life. I never reacted like other people, like normal people, to situations in life. And I came to realize that. My father was an alcoholic, and he did the best job that he could do in providing for his family. His parents were both alcoholic. His brother died in this disease. My father's nephew hung himself in prison. My brother's been to prison. It runs through our family. My mother is the only one who has escaped, but she is the daughter of two alcoholics, and she is a flaming codependent. I'm raising three alcoholic children, none of whom are in this program. They do reap the benefits of this program because their mother is sober, and I can live a different life. You know, I've only been sober for 5 years. They're 28, 25, and be 21 next week. And so they lived this life. They lived this hell. The disease of alcoholism destroyed our family many times. I took several prisoners along the way. But I'll tell you about that, too. But I was always feeling different from a very young age. I remember now always wishing that I was someplace else instead of here in the now where we're taught to live today one day at a time. Because we can't find anything out there or over there. We can only find the peace and happiness right here in this moment, in this room, right now. But I never lived there. I lived in my if-onlys and whens and shoulds and coulds and woulds because I would be happy when you did this or if you only did that. Okay, it was never about me because my happiness was dependent upon what everybody else in my life did. And so therefore I was restless, irritable, and discontent for quite a number of years. And therefore so the people in my life suffered because it came out sideways. It came out in rage, which I didn't realize was just anger. And, you know, I stuffed it for a long time. We weren't allowed to show emotions in our family. My mother had a tear jar. And if you fell down or you got a spanking, you couldn't cry because she was going to catch it, you know, which she thought was really a cute thing. But all it did was tell me that it was not okay to feel. It wasn't okay to be sad. If I had a difference of opinion with my parents as I was a teenager, I could go to my room till I got over it. It was a Southern girl, yes sir, yes ma'am. And because I wanted to please and because I felt different and because Daddy was, you know, roaring in his disease, I thought that if I did better and acted better, that then Mother and Daddy would be happy. So see, I have been trying to control things all my life. Trying to control the outcome, what you thought of me by my actions, never searching with inside myself for my happiness. Never drank as a teenager. I had, you know, my parents gave me pretty much what, well, it was the only normal life I knew, okay? Till I came into this room, I really thought my life was normal. I don't hold my parents responsible for anything. I'm fortunately, by the grace of God, not been sexually abused. I do not have that in my story. We went to church. They were kind and loving. They provided. They gave me an education. They clothed me. They fed me. They gave me a good place, you know, to live. It was what, again, that I thought about it and how I felt about it. And I know that today. And I can be grateful for that today and appreciate the things that I had today, which I never could do before because I was always just like, can y'all not get it together because we live on the wrong side of town and I don't have this and I don't have that. And they did the very best they could to give it to me. And you know what? I never was happy. I went off to college. That was my first geographic, I now realize, because I couldn't go to college in Arkansas because all the people that I never got along with that were never my friends anyway, you know, we're all going to go up there. So I went to the University of Alabama, and I had real good credentials for picking out the school. You know, it was red and white colors. It was a good football school, and I heard it was great for partying. And so, you know, I had no idea what I was going to study when I got there because I had been bred to keep my expectations real low and to, that, you know, the main thing that I wanted was, you know, to graduate from college but to get married and have children. And so that's really what I did. But the summer before I went to college was when I had my first drink. You know, I was 18 years old. But the minute that I had that drink, I knew I had arrived. I was finally there. And you know where that place is when you have gotten there, all capital letters. And then every other drink I ever had, I was trying to get back there. Okay? Not here. Remember, I sure didn't want to be here. But I had gotten there, which was outside of me. And all of a sudden, you know, I was popular, I could dance, I could, you know, drink like the big people. My mother told me that if I drank, I would get pregnant, because that's what happened to her. And she had caught me doing everything else that I'd ever tried to do. And so So I didn't drink. I didn't do those things that I wasn't supposed to do. You know, people, and you talk about being a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was a Dr. Jekyll and a Miss Goody Two Shoes. I mean, because if I acted perfect and dressed perfect and did the things that you wanted me to do and made A's in school and participated in all the things that you wanted me to do, then I would be happy and that I would be okay and you would be okay with me, which was the biggest thing, was just seeking that outside approval so that I could possibly feel okay in my own skin, but it still didn't work. But anyway, back to college, I started drinking, had a great time, partied hard, but the minute that I had that drink, I do believe that I was an alcoholic. I crossed the line immediately. I haven't admitted also until just recently that I had blackouts because I used to pass out all the time. I would tell people that I would brown out. Okay? You know, because that was just kind of like sort of didn't remember what was happening. And so my denial runs very deep. But from that very moment that I took that first drink, the rest of my life until I stopped drinking revolved around the next drink. If I wasn't thinking about drinking, I was thinking about not drinking, and that's thinking about drinking. Okay? It was, if I do this, then I can drink. When I do this, then I can have that drink. It was all about getting to the next drink. Because as soon as I was able to get to that drink, all of a sudden I had that sense of relief. That magic spot where I didn't have to be me anymore. Because I just did not accept or like who I was. Okay? I have these real extremes that I'll tell you, okay? Because I felt like a pile of shit, but also I expected the world to revolve around me. Okay? I was the worst, but I was the best. Never anywhere in the middle. And as a dutiful child and what I went to college for, since my mother told me if I couldn't, if I was going to have sex, I had to get married. So, okay, let's get married. Because I was drinking and things were starting to, feel good or want to feel good. And so I found a likely candidate. And his credentials were they had a matching car and boat. No, okay. Tells you a little thing, something about my judgment. Okay, it didn't matter, a whole lot about anything. He is not an alcoholic, and he was a very willing participant. He did the very best he could to make that marriage work. We have two beautiful children, and he's not an alcoholic. And I'll never forget this. We were married, it's about 6 years, and about the fifth year, right after our son was born, I looked in the mirror one day, and all of a sudden I saw this person in the mirror, and I said, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" I mean, I had been just acting out what I thought I needed to be and who he needed me to be and who his family needed me to be so that I could fit in where I was at the moment. I was the chameleon. I can do this, folks. You want me to take sewing lessons? Okay. You want me to have a party at Christmas? Okay, I can do this. And I did it with the best of them because I could drink to take the edge off, and then I could do it to perfection. But let me tell you something. It was Mach 5 hair on fire, crash and burn, because I only knew one speed. Because if I had to stop at some point and couldn't have a drink, guess who was going to be there? Me. And I couldn't live with that person. And so I know that my persistent movement and involvement and all of this wonderful community service and church work and things that I did, at the time, it was just self-seeking. It was self-serving. It was just me not being able to be with myself. I never knew how to be just with me. Not that I really wanted to be with you either, because you were probably going to want to talk about you, and I sure didn't want to talk about you. I wanted to talk about me. We ended up getting divorced, now I know, his sister said she has gone crazy. She is absolutely a lunatic. She has lost her mind. And I thought, who is she? Listen to her. I'm not crazy. But yes, I was. Yes, I was. And I've made amends to that family. And I've been back. My ex-father-in-law died, and I went back to the funeral. And they said, man, this is the only place that the ex-daughter-in-law would be, taking care of everything in the background while they took care of, what needed to be done. I was able to get out of myself enough because I was in recovery to be there for those people and to make amends to them by suiting up and showing up and by loving them when they were in a time of need. But I went back to Arkansas because that's where they would love me and care for me, and I could get fixed again, could get filled back up because I was extremely empty and hollow. And they did. My daddy was my enabler. If something needed fixing, that's the Arkansas word, okay? If it needed fixing, he could fix it. And so I went back there, and what I did was found a really good babysitter. My mother loved the children. She took care of the children, and I picked out my next hostage. Because, see, what I have also learned in here is that I was taking people as hostages because I thought this human power could relieve me of whatever it was to make me feel okay. I didn't know that it was alcoholism. I didn't know that I had this huge hole in my soul that I was trying to fill with other people. I guess it needed to be a man, okay? And when I was growing up, we couldn't be members of the country club because Daddy was this beer salesman. And so I'd always just dreamt, you know, because if I could just be a member of the country club, then I would be okay. So I married the golf professional. And, that Bill talks about that in his story, you know, about Walter Hagen, you know, how it was a great excuse to drink day and night. It was nothing but a big party. I mean, I had great clothes and good clubs and all the wine I could possibly, have to drink, and I don't even know how to do anything. I don't even know that I ever hit those clubs, but man, did I look good out there. I thought I did, because that's all that mattered, you know. It was a great excuse to party, and finally I was among the people that I thought I needed to be with, the ones that I wanted to be like, the ones that had the cars and could take the trips and could do all of those things that I wanted to be able to do. You know, it talks in the book also about, you know, being in bars and about talking in millions, okay, and spending in thousands. Well, I did that, you know, because we were able to be at those types of country clubs, real affluent places where people could wine and dine us and take us places. And they talked in millions and they spent in thousands. You know, I didn't have but hundreds. And so, but I tried to live that way. And I've had to make amends for that too, because I tried to blame my second husband for all the problems, because he gambled and he was never at home. And, you know, I had these kids and I had another kid. And, God, you know, if you were me and you had my life. And my oldest daughter is a special needs child. And it was very demanding to be able to care for her. And if you had my life, you know, you would drink too. You know, I had no other outlet, because remember, I was still restless, irritable, and discontent. And the only way that I could manage, okay, because I was trying to manage and trying to control everybody and everything, because if I could keep everybody, and they called me a drill sergeant, because I was so extremely organized. I took my children's socks when I would get them new pairs of socks and put color-coded embroidery thread in the little toes, like, and so that they would wear them, you know, like green, red, yellow, blue, and then green, red, yellow, blue, and they would only wear them together so that they would all, you know, get worn the same amount, you know, and that kind of, but that's I was crazy, you know, and this poor guy lived with me for 15 years. You'd drink too, wouldn't you? You know? And he did drink, and we drank together, and we partied. And it was verbally abusive. It was emotionally abusive times. I didn't fight. I didn't fight back. I just, you know, like I said, you know, we've been taught to stuff our emotions. But when he would drink, he would get very, very verbal. And all I did was just try to take care of the kids and protect the kids and keep it going, you know. It was my pride and my ego, because probably should have divorced them, you know, years before. My pride and my ego would not allow me to do that. I thought, man, you know, twice, Lord, I can't be divorced twice. You know, once is bad enough, but, you know, I will never be able to go back to my class reunion. Well, who wants to, you know? I didn't like those people anyway. You know, I left there, you know, and never wanted to come back. But I did go back because, see, I needed help. And so when I needed help, I went back to my family. And it was, Daddy was getting into a lot of his alcoholism. You know, the family was falling apart. It was very difficult to keep it together. We ended up moving away to Minnesota. And I've been to hell. I don't care to go back. It's very cold there. You know, you have to wear your long underwear in the grocery store. You know, it's just that kind of bitter cold to me. But my alcoholism really took off there, because the days were gray and cold and the sun didn't shine. And I was lonely and I was miserable and I didn't know why. And, you know, I never had the desire to stop drinking, but I did have the desire during those times to control it better. Okay, so I would quit for Lent, and that would always work 1 year. Then the next year, that was a little drastic, okay, so I'd just give up wine this time. So I started drinking Jack Daniels, you know. And only on Sunday that year, you know. And then the next year, it was like, okay, you can just drink Jack Daniels all through the week. Just give up the wine. So, you know, I can go back and look at my history and my pattern, and I can see how the disease progressed for me and how it just changed for me. You know, if this wasn't working, then I would change it with this. I did not use drugs. I did speed one time in college, and I so freaked out on it that I just, you know, I like to be down. I don't like to be up. I realized that I didn't like it that night that I did it. I got into my chemistry exam and hallucinated. You know, I ended up, by the grace of God, pulling out a C in that class because I know that I didn't take that exam. Because I don't know where I was, but I wasn't there. And so I didn't do drugs. I was strictly an alcoholic, but I drank plenty of wine. And, you know, whatever else pretty much was available at the time, if that wasn't there. But I would switch, you know, bait and switch, whatever you want to call it. You know, I did this, I mixed it with that, I'd try this, I'd try a little of that. I had to quit drinking amaretto because it really started making me get angry and volatile and wanting to fight back with this husband that was already, and I knew that I would end up getting hurt. And so I just quit drinking amaretto. So I started drinking White Russians. That's good stuff. You know, that worked too for a while. But anyway, it just really got out of hand living in Minnesota. I did realize at that point that it was a problem for me. My father had quit drinking at that point. I didn't realize that his little pearls of wisdom when I would call him with my sad tale of woe, this time, what is it this time? You know, and he would start these little things now, because he died before I came into recovery. And the things that he would tell me, I now know those little pearls of wisdom, he got right here. You know, he was able to bring some laughter and some joy and a little bit of peace and stability back into our family because he was sober. And, you know, for that, I'm very, very grateful. But he did just die, even with, you know, some time in recovery as a result of the years of drinking. You know, his body just couldn't carry on any longer, even after he was sober. So it takes a toll on us, even, you know, for the years that we drank. In Minnesota, I did realize that I had to do something, okay, because I was so sad and I was so lonely, and we couldn't leave there, you know, because I couldn't get divorced again. You know, it would just be too humiliating, and so I just drank. You know, and I just shut down. I would get the kids up, and I would take them to school, and I would come back, and I was so depressed because, see, my self-pity had gotten so low and so deep down in myself. You know, I was so angry at myself for putting myself in a situation that I couldn't have the courage to get out of. And I put myself, and I loathed myself, and that self-pity turned into depression. And I know that's what it was today. And so I would just, you know, lay on the bed until it was, and if the sun came through the windows at any place, I would just go and just lay in it and try to get some sunshine. Because I do know today that the sunshine for me is a real natural healing source of my higher power that comes to me. I call it the sunlight of the Spirit. And I know that it fills me and warms me with a sense of God's presence from nature. But I didn't know it at the time, but that was one of the behaviors I would do. At that time, too, my life, I became much more isolated. The children would come home. I would fix them dinner. They would get their homework and do what they had to do. I didn't drink during the day. I didn't drink till 5 o'clock because that would make me a problem drinker. Okay? Very far from an alcoholic, but I could admit that I might have a problem if I started drinking before 5. But I would go to bed, you know, with the wine on the table. And we lived there for 4 years. And by the end of the fourth year, right before we moved, I was spending most of my life in the corner of my closet. Very, very sad, lonely place to be. I was just afraid and lonely and isolated from the world and so shut down that's the only place I felt safe, just like a scared animal, you know, curled into the closet. And I know today that if I get a thought, okay, then I had an idea, you know, to go to the closet, that I better call my sponsor because there is something big time going on in me that I've got to get out, because that's a behavior that I've learned to identify is, you know, getting back into my self-pity And then I need to identify the feelings that are going with that and the actions that I'm taking, you know, to get myself back out of there, because I don't want to live there. I lived there for quite a long time. My husband lost his job again. He, you know, stayed unemployed. I worked a couple of different jobs to keep the family going, but he was able to get a job, and we moved to Phoenix, Arizona. That was a great place, and much warmer. Sun shines there. And but the night before we were to move, my daddy died. And so I picked up the kids, and I went to Arkansas, and my life fell apart. Our whole lives fell apart. Our whole family fell apart. Mother was the one that pretty much kept things together, but when daddy died, we didn't know what to do. We had that no sense that the unity was not there, and we all just fell apart and kind of went our different ways. And I went to Arizona. Life was horrible. It was just getting worse. Of course, daddy wasn't there. I really fell deeper and deeper into the depression. My brother was really acting out. Mother was having a hard time. He was back in jail before he went to prison. And it was on Thanksgiving that year. And my son told me, he said, Mom, he said, you have got to pull it together because we really need you. And so I went to a counselor, therapist. I said, okay, I can do that. And so I went, and he sat there, and he said, tell me about it. And so I told him all of this whole story, just like what I'm telling you guys, and how it was everybody else's fault, and if they would only do this. And, you know, and my life was so sad, and my dad had just died. And he said, well, tell me about your drinking. I said, oh, I don't drink much. I just drink two a day, you know. And he goes, oh, okay. And he said, well, what do you think about, since all these other people in your life are alcoholics and have problems, that maybe you could go to Al-Anon? And I went, oh, okay. So I went to Al-Anon that night, the very first night. Man, I was a gung-ho Al-Anon, 90 and 90, but I could not stop drinking. And they were talking about me in there. You know, it was not nice, the things they were saying. And so I quietly, because my family, I told them what I was doing, and they didn't think it was that I needed to be that drastic, Mom. But so I slid across the hall into AA. I came in through. It was at a clubhouse, and so I came in through the back door, and I was home. But I didn't grasp the program. I did as far as the outward things. You know, I did service work. I went to the meetings. I sold the raffle tickets. The second year, I did. You know, some other service work. I was the secretary of the group and all these wonderful things. But I was, you know, I hadn't done the second part of step one. I'd done a little bit of three. I'd kind of glazed over four. Certainly wasn't thinking about making amends, because remember, it's about everybody else. I had not done one thing wrong in my whole life. And so, you know, and so I drank again. When the self-pity, once again, and the feelings within myself were so bad, that I had not found a higher power. I had gone to church all of my life, and I did have an understanding of God, but I did not have a connection. And when it was, you know, when it was time for the rubber to meet the road, there was nobody there to help me. And God forbid that I would have called my sponsor and asked for help, because I just had not learned to do that, because I still didn't trust you people. You know, I could not let you know who I was, because if you really knew who I was, you wouldn't love me. You wouldn't want me to be here, and I would be all alone again. And I couldn't, you know, I couldn't chance that, because you made me feel so good and you made me feel so loved. And I went out and I drank again for a month. I came back in, and I became willing. I had finally found the gift of desperation. I had had enough, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get sober. Got right into the steps. This time I realized that I was, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. This is a we program. I can't do it without you. I hope that you have to have me, as you do tonight, to be a part of that. We is only on there one time that you can see, but it's actually in the 12 steps 12 times. You can find the word we in there 12 times if you look later on. But you got to come back and listen to me right now. So don't go there. Come back here. But, you know, I could not, in the beginning, admit that my life was unmanageable. But I finally had to surrender to the fact that it was unmanageable by me. And then I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Because By this time, I had to admit that my ex-sister-in-law was maybe a little bit right, you know, that I was insane, because it's a disease of the mind. And all my life, I had tried to solve my problems with the same level of thinking that created them, which was between my ears, because I didn't ask for help. I just kept doing the same thing over and over and over again. And I was so desperate to have a new way of life that I, you know, if I had to admit that somebody else could do it, you know, I had always given my power to my mother to make my decisions, you know, to my husband's to make my decisions, anybody else that would make them, because then I didn't have to be accountable and responsible, and I could, you know, to be the eternal victim. You know, when I was whining in the rooms one day, and, you know, they just let me talk. They were so wonderful. And a guy said, "Get off the cross. They need the wood." You know? You know? And you know, that was kind and loving, I know. And but I was able to understand that I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, but as coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, that higher power would empower me to make choices in my life that were healthy and good. And so I was willing. I was still very mad at him, but, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of choices out there. I'd not gotten a DUI. I've not ever been to jail, but those are yets for me, and I know it. This is where I belong. I was ready to kill myself, and I decided that I really didn't want to kill myself and that I wanted to live. And if this was the only way that I could live, then let's do it. Show me what it is that you need me to do. I'm willing to come along. And so, you know, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over the care of God as I understood him. Pedro, over at my Saturday morning meeting, he says, you know, just because we make a decision doesn't mean that we're going to be a brain surgeon tomorrow. And because it takes years of practice once you decide, you've got to go to school, you've got to do all those things. I made a decision that I was going to turn my will over. I get up every morning and I say the third step prayer. I say it several times during the day along with the serenity prayer. Sometimes serenity prayer is too short for me to find, you know, when I'm wanting to react to something and I need to take the pause like it tells us to do on page 86, that I can stop and gather my thoughts and I can say the third step prayer and gather my thoughts and turn my will and my life back over to the care of God as I understand him. But when I decided to make that decision, it told me to immediately to get into action, and that was the fourth step. And I had not done that previously, and so I knew that I had to do it. And I had to list my resentments. And a resentment, we were talking about this on the way over here, you know, if I want to nurse a resentment, it's like taking poison and expecting somebody else to die. Because it is not going to hurt them a bit, it is only going to hurt me. And so I listed my resentments, and I looked at those resentments and why I had them and why I was angry. And, you know, and then I had to look at, you know, what was the cause of all of that? Why was I angry? You know, because I was selfish. I was self-centered. My pride, my ambition, my personal relationships, my sexual relationships. You know, all of that that I had carried with me forever was the reason that I was angry and had these resentments about people. And then from looking at my part in that, I was able to determine what the fear was. And at that point, I did realize that my life was run by 100 forms of fear, self-pity, self-seeking, and self-delusion. You know, it was in every strand of my being. Everything that I did had a fear underlying it. And that's why, you know, I was so afraid, and I didn't want to be alone. You know, my fears, my big fears are the fear of being alone. They're a fear of you people, you know, of trusting you people, because if I trust you, you might want to try to control me. You know, those were my fears. My financial insecurity. And I identified those. And now when I get afraid, I can say, what are you afraid of? What's really underneath this? You're not. If I'm pointing a finger over here at Susan, I got three pointing back at me. Because if I spot it, I got it. And if I'm pointing that finger at you, it's only because I see it in myself. And it's something that I need to do something about. I've got to always be willing to look at my side. I don't have to turn away and say that they don't have a part. But I have to be willing to come halfway. Now I forgot to tell you I got married a third time. I always try to forget that because I really don't. And I got married in the program shortly after my first birthday, and that was part of the reason that I went back out and was so into self-pity, but because I finally realized to my innermost self that there were three people that were the same in these marriages, and it was me. you know. And so if we were still having the same problems in all three of these marriages, then guess who the problem was? Brooke. But that's where the big self-pity came in, is because that was really a big chunk that I had to swallow about myself, was that I really had to change and I didn't know how to have relationships with people. But the fear is what separated me from God. It's what separated me from myself, and it's what separated me from all of you. And by cleaning house and, you know, clearing up the wreckage of my past, which I continued to do after I did that fearless and searching inventory, and I did a sexual inventory. Only last year did it finally occur to me that I wasn't trying to find the perfect partner. You know, I was writing my sexual ideal, you know, and he looked like this and he looked like that. That's not what it's about. It's about me, and it's about becoming the person, the woman that God wants me to be, about having the sexual ideal and what kind of relationship that I hope and I pray for. And that when I'm the woman that God wants me to be, he'll put that person in my life to be able to share that life with me. But I've got to be ready for that. I've got to prepare myself for that. My sponsor early on told me, she said, there's only one thing you've got to change in recovery, and that's everything. And I've realized also in a relationship that I have to change everything. The minute that something agitates me, I got to say, uh-oh, because see, the way I wanted to do it didn't work, and I know it didn't work, and it didn't work because I was there. And so I have to call and ask somebody, how do I do this differently? What can I do differently so that this might work? So that I can allow someone to love me? Because, you know, that scares me. That really scares me. Because then I might have to get out of myself to share some of myself at an intimate level. And that's really a scary place for me. But that's what I learned, you know, through doing my inventory. And I continue to do an inventory, and I'm real excited about doing it this year because I know that it'll reveal some other things about myself. And even though sometimes they are not pretty, and I want to hang on to them because they're painful, that emotional pain is another thing that I'm very afraid of because I don't want to feel that. But only every time have I been willing to feel that level of emotional pain and to share it with my sponsor and with other women in recovery, am I able to walk through it, to sit there in it and not drink, not take a drink, not act out on it, not hurt other people because of my fear. And on the other side of that, by acting differently, behaving differently, okay, over a period of time my thinking changes. And then I begin to respond differently in situations more naturally. Okay, it's not natural for me to act that way. It's not natural for me to be kind and loving to people. It's not natural for me not to sit here and judge you. I mean, I got a whole room of people I could be judging, you know, and that's not natural for me because those are the things that I do. Those are my character defects. Those are the things that ran through every thread of my life. But I became, you know, willing to share this with another person, and I shared it, you know, and I had to level my ego, and I had to humbly, before God and another person, tell him all, every bit of those innermost secrets. Some of the little things keep coming up again, and I go to my sponsor and I tell her, you know, what a horrible person that I think that I am. And she reminds me that I'm just a sick person trying to get well. Okay? But my secrets will keep me sick. My secrets live in my mind where my disease is. You know, my disease, I drank and it just set off that physical, you know, compulsion. You know, it's the mental obsession. I only knew how to relieve what was, and I still get there. I have been nuttier than 10 cases of fruitcakes about coming to speak to you guys. And, you know, and it's because it was all fear. It was all going on up in my head, and what were you going to think about me? And so, you know, I just have to get back into the program, and I have to tell my fears to someone else, I have to tell my secrets to someone else, to let someone see me, to be invisible. Okay, to be totally open to that someone else, you know, and a lot of times we end up laughing about it, you know, or we end up crying about it, but we end up sharing that. And that's having a relationship with another person, and that's because I have faith in my higher power, and I've learned to trust other people, and I've learned to trust myself. And But after I did my steps, I went downstairs for an hour in her home. And I, you know, took some time, and I felt like I had thoroughly done it. So then we did step 7, and we got down on our knees, and I asked God and told him that I was now ready for him to remove every single defect of character that I had. Now, that didn't happen all at once, because I keep doing that on a daily basis. And I've been working on it a lot this year because, just like I told you, I'm continuing as I work this program to see more truths about myself. And as I do, I'm able to ask God to remove those things from me. And I do mean it. And I want to be a different person. So I've got to be willing to let him have those character defects. I'd made a list of the persons I harmed. And that's where the freedom really came. When I contacted those people, when I wrote those letters, when I did the things that I needed to do, was when the burden, I was able to drop the rock. You know, all of that weight that I'd felt like I'd been carrying around forever, the majority of it was finally lifted from me. And that's God. That's God for me. That's you people, okay? Because when I share my load with another person, they're going to carry some of it for me. Okay? When I'm having emotional pain, because see, what happens to me is when I realize that I've got one of these character defects coming up, okay, I'm going to hold on to it really, really tight. And by the time that I'm in enough pain to realize that if I let it go, I'm going to have the joy and the freedom on the other side. But by the time I do, it has got claw marks all over it because I have held on to it all the way down because it doesn't feel natural to me. Those things are things that used to work for me. They really didn't, but I thought they did. But they really don't work for me today because they separate me from God, from myself, and from you. And after I made those direct amends, like I said, it set me on a new path of freedom and of happiness. I continue to take personal inventory on a daily basis. And when I'm wrong, I promptly admit it. I read page 85, 86, 87, and 88 every morning and every night because I didn't know how to pray. And it taught me, and my sponsor told me how to do that. She also told me that if I had an idea, I better call her. Because anytime I had an idea, I was going to do something that I didn't want to do. Because my best thinking told me to do the same thing that had gotten me here. And so when I had that type of thinking, and again today, at the end of the day, there's seven questions. When we retire at night, there's seven questions in the big book. This big book tells us exactly what to do. It's a set of tools, of spiritual instructions, so that we can live a happy life. And it gives us those seven questions, and we review it. I mean, I have to cough it up. I'm telling you, I have to go right to that person because I start getting real edgy. And I call it my red flag goes up. And when that red flag goes up, I go, you know, okay, I'm going to be restless, irritable, and discontent until I'm willing to go make this amends, until I own my part of this. And then I'd go do, and then it becomes okay. And then I can identify why I did it and try not to do it next time. Doesn't mean that I'm not going to, okay, because I am human. I've accepted that about myself too, okay. My name is Connie Queen, and I am the queen of everything, you know, and everybody and the universe. And so, you know, I will let you share it with me, but you have to admit that I'm the queen, so. that was my second marriage. My last name was Nutt, N-U-T-T. Okay. So y'all don't think I was ready to get rid of that one, do you? So I found this guy named Randy Queen. There you go. You know, got my last name. And I'll probably stick with it, you know. But anyway, and I sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. I do spend quite a bit of time every morning in prayer and meditation. I've learned how to breathe and how to quiet my mind. When I pray, I'm speaking to God, but God can't give me those intuitive thoughts or decisions unless I'm quiet and I listen to Him. Scares me when He does it, and I find, okay. You know, because I don't stop long enough. I'm still learning how to be a being person, because remember I was a doing person before. And I'm learning how to be a being person. And when I can quiet my mind and I can settle myself down, then I can allow myself to hear God. And I can begin to trust that. It tells us then there in the beginning when we're doing this that we'll have some absurd actions and ideas, and that's true. I still do that. But every once in a while when I'm praying and then I listen, I get an intuitive thought or an idea, and you know what? And I go and do that. I go and take action on that, and it works. And I have a relationship with the person that I wouldn't have had because I allow God to work with me and to go with me. You know, if I go into a job interview, I open the door, and I say, after you, God, because when He's there and I take Him with me, which I do, then I'm not alone. You know, one of my biggest fears is of being alone. I mean, I don't trust you, okay? And I don't want you to control me, but I don't want to be alone. You know, those extremes, okay? How my fears, you know, are just huge extremes. And having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I don't know, I told you I thought I crossed into alcoholism right away. I did not have a spiritual awakening right away. I fought this, and when I came back in the third step, it was really hard for me, to make that decision to turn my will over to God, because I was really angry at him because Daddy had died, and he took my daddy from me. And then I had to admit that I was an alcoholic to my innermost self. I had to surrender it up, and I was really mad at him. But my counselor, she looked at me, and of course at that time she said, "How much did you drink?" And I said, "Two glasses." I was in an institution, just like some of you people have been, and she said, "Two glasses? Bring me that glass." It was a 52-ounce mug. That's a lot of wine. But I have had a spiritual awakening as the result of working these steps. I couldn't find God in a book. I didn't find God in a church. I do go to church today, and I have a real different understanding of the faith that I choose to practice. But I have had a spiritual awakening, but it's the result of working these steps. It's the only way I got it, folks. When women come to me and ask me to sponsor them, I say, "Well, we're going to have a little meet and greet, and I'm going to tell you how I do it. And if you want what I have, then I'll walk this path with you." And some of them never call me back. Most of them don't call me back, because I work this program. Because if I don't, my disease will work me. Because when I'm in my alcoholism, that ism stands for I sponsor myself. And I did that for a long time, and it does not work. And I try to carry this message to other alcoholics, and I work with other women. And I have beautiful women that share their lives with me. And because of this program, my children and I have a renewed relationship. My mother and I have a different type of relationship. I have a special person in my life today that I haven't been able to run off yet. I've tried, but I'm also trying to do it differently. And I'm trying to live a different life today. And I'm pretty much able to do that. I get crazy because I get up in my mind and I think for a minute that I might have a better way of doing this. But I'm telling you, I don't always know when I'm connected with God, but I dadgum sure know when I'm not. Because the restless irritability and discontent comes right back in. I've had it all my life. That's my natural state. And if I want to be happy, joyous, and free, I work this program. I pray to God every morning and every night, ask him to keep me sober and thank him. And I come to these meetings, and I work with other people. And thank you so much for letting me share with you tonight. It's been a gift.
Thank you, Connie. That was great. I really appreciate that. That was wonderful. I appreciate that. You really show me the growth, and it has changed. Your message has changed quite a bit since the last time you told it, and that shows me how much growth this program will allow us.